Disc 6.
Chapter 10. Tynesham. There was little likelihood of anyone missing the manor. Beyond the few cottages which constituted the village of Tynesham, the high wall of an estate ran beside the road. We followed it until we came to massive wrought-iron gates. Behind them stood a young woman on whose face the sober seriousness of responsibility had suppressed all human expression. She was equipped with a shotgun, which she clasped in inappropriate places. I signalled to Coker to stop, and called to her as I drew up. Her mouth moved, but not a word penetrated the clatter of the engine. I switched off. "This is Tynesham Manor?" I asked. She was not giving that or anything else away. "Where are you from? And how many of you?" she countered. I could have wished that she did not fiddle about with her gun in just the way she did. Briefly, and keeping an eye on her uneasy fingers, I explained who we were, why we came, roughly what we carried, and guaranteed that there were no more of us hidden in the trucks. I doubted whether she was taking it in. Her eyes were fixed on mine with a mournfully speculative expression more common in bloodhounds, but not reassuring even there. My words did little to disperse the random suspicion which makes the highly conscientious so wearing. As she emerged to glance into the backs of the lorries and verify my statements, I hoped for her sake that she would not chance to encounter a party of whom her suspicions were justified. Admission that she was satisfied would have weakened her role of reliability, but she did eventually consent, still with reserve, to allow us in. "Take the right fork," she called up to me as I passed, and turned back at once to attend to the security of the gates. Beyond a short avenue of elms lay a park landscaped in the manner of the late 18th century, and dotted with trees which had had space to expand into full magnificence. The house, when it came into view, was not a stately home in the architectural sense, but there was a lot of it. It rambled over a considerable ground area, and through a variety of building styles, as though none of its previous owners had been able to resist the temptation to leave his personal mark upon it. Each, while respecting the work of his forefathers, had apparently felt it incumbent upon him to express the spirit of his own age. A confident disregard of previous levels had resulted in a sturdy waywardness. It was inescapably a funny house, yet friendly and reliable-looking. The right fork led us to a wide courtyard where several vehicles stood already. Coach houses and stables extended around it, seemingly over several acres. Coker drew up alongside me and climbed down. There was no one in sight. We made our way through the open rear door of the main building and down a long corridor. At the end of it was a kitchen of baronial capacity where the warmth and smell of cooking lingered. From beyond a door on the far side came a murmur of voices and a clatter of plates, but we had to negotiate a further dark passage and another door before we reached them. The place we entered had, I imagine, been the servants' hall in the days when staffs were sufficiently large for the term to be no misnomer. It was spacious enough to seat 100 or more at tables without crowding. The present occupants, seated on benches at 2 long trestles, I guessed to number between 50 and 60, and it was clear at a glance that they were blind. While they sat patiently, a few sighted persons were very busy. Over at a side table, 3 girls were industriously carving chickens. I went up to one of them. "We've just come," I said. "What do we do?" She paused, still clutching her fork, and pushed back a lock of hair with the crook of her wrist. "It'll help if one of you takes charge of the veg and the other helps with the plates," she said. I took command of 2 large tubs of potato and cabbage. In the intervals of doling them out, I looked over the occupants of the hall. Josella was not amongst them, nor could I see any of the more notable characters among the group that had put forward its proposals at the university building, though I fancied I had seen the faces of some of the women before. The proportion of men was far higher than in the former group, and they were curiously assorted. A few of them might have been Londoners, or at least town dwellers, but the majority wore a countryman's working clothes. An exception to either kind was a middle-aged clergyman, but what every one of the men had in common was blindness. The women were more diversified. Some were in town clothes quite unsuited to their surroundings, others were probably local. Among the latter group only one girl was sighted, but the former group comprised half a dozen or so who could see, and a number who, though blind, were not clumsy. Coker, too, had been taking stock of the place. "Rum sort of set up this," he remarked sotto voce to me. "Have you seen her yet?" I shook my head, desolately aware that I had pinned more on the expectation of finding Gisella there than I had admitted to myself. "Funny thing," he went on, "there's practically none of the lot I took along with you, except that girl that's carving up at the end there."
"Has she recognized you?" I said.
"I think so. I got a sort of dirty look from her."
When the carrying and serving had been completed, we took our own plates and found places at the table. There was nothing to complain of in the cooking or the food, and living out of cold cans for a week sharpens the appreciation anyway. At the end of the meal there was a knocking on the table. The clergyman rose. He waited for silence before he spoke.
"My friends, it is fitting that at the end of another day we should renew our thanks to God for his great mercy in preserving us in the midst of such disaster. I will ask you all to pray that he may look with compassion upon those who still wander alone in darkness, and that it may please him to guide their feet hither that we may succour them. Let us all beseech him that we may survive the trials and tribulations that lie ahead, in order that in his time and with his aid we may succeed in playing our part in the rebuilding of a better world to his greater glory." He bowed his head. "Almighty and most merciful God."
After the Amen, he led a hymn. When that was finished, the gathering sorted itself out into parties, each keeping touch with his neighbour, and four of the sighted girls led them out. I lit a cigarette. Coker took one from me absent-mindedly without making any comment. A girl came across to us.
"Will you help to clear up?" she asked. "Miss Durrant will be back soon, I expect."
"Miss Durrant," I repeated.
"She does the organizing," she explained. "You'll be able to fix things up with her."
It was an hour later and almost dark when we heard that Miss Durrant had returned. We found her in a small study-like room lit only by two candles on the desk. I recognized her at once as the dark, thin-lipped woman who had spoken for the opposition at the meeting. For the moment, all her attention was concentrated on Coker. Her expression was no more amiable than upon the former occasion.
"I am told," she said coldly, regarding Coker as though he was some kind of silt. "I am told that you are the man who organized the raid on the university building."
Coker agreed and waited.
"Then I may as well tell you once and for all that in our community here we have no use for brutal methods and no intention of tolerating them."
Coker smiled slightly. He answered her in his best middle-class speech. "It is a matter of viewpoint. Who is to judge who were the more brutal, those who saw an immediate responsibility and stayed, or those who saw a further responsibility and cleared out?" She continued to look hard at him. Her expression remained unchanged, but she was evidently forming a different judgment of the type of man she had to deal with. Neither his reply nor its manner had been quite what she had expected. She shelved that aspect for a time and turned to me.
"Were you in that too?" she asked.
I explained my somewhat negative part in the affair and put my own question.
"What happened to Michael Beadley, the colonel and the rest?"
It was not well received.
"They have gone elsewhere," she said sharply. "This is a clean, decent community with standards, Christian standards, and we intend to uphold them. We have no place here for people of loose views. Decadence, immorality, and lack of faith were responsible for most of the world's ills. It is the duty of those of us who have been spared to see that we build a society where that does not happen again. The cynical and the clever will find that they are not wanted here, no matter what brilliant theories they may put forward to disguise their licentiousness and their materialism. We are a Christian community, and we intend to remain so."
She looked at me challengingly.
"So you split, did you?" I said.
"Where did they go?"
She replied stonily.
"They moved on, and we stayed here. That is what matters. So long as they keep their influence away from here, they may work out their own damnation as they please. And since they choose to consider themselves superior to both the laws of God and civilized custom, I have no doubt that they will.
She ended this declaration with a snap of the jaw which suggested that I should be wasting my time if I tried to question further, and turned back to Coker.
"What can you do?"
she inquired.
"A number of things," he said calmly. "I suggest that I make myself generally useful until I see where I am needed most."
She hesitated, a little taken aback. It had clearly been her intention to make the decision and issue the instruction, but she changed her mind.
"All right, look round, and come and talk it over tomorrow evening," she said.
But Coco was not to be dismissed quite so easily. He wanted particulars of the size of the estate, the number of persons at present in the house, the proportion of sighted to blind, along with a number of other matters, and he got them. Before we left, I put in a question about Josella. Miss Durrant frowned.
"I seem to know that name. Now, where... Oh, did she stand in the Conservative interest in the last election?"
"I don't think so. She, did write a book once," I admitted.
She
began. Then I saw recollection dawn.
Oh, that. Well, really, Mr. Mason, I can scarcely think she would be the sort of person to care for in the kind of community we are building here."
In the corridor outside, Coker turned to me. There was just enough of the twilight left for me to see his grin. "A somewhat oppressive orthodoxy around these parts," he remarked. The grin disappeared as he added, "Rum type, you know. Pride and Prejudice. She's wanting help. She knows she needs it badly, but nothing's going to make her admit it." He paused opposite an open door. It was almost too dark now to make out anything in the room, but when we had passed it before, there had been enough light to reveal it as a men's dormitory. "I'm going in to have a word with these chaps. See you later." I watched him stroll into the room and greet it collectively with a cheerful,
"Watch your mates! How's it going?"
and then made my own way back to the dining hall. The only light there came from three candles set close together on one table. Close beside them a girl peered exasperatedly at some mending.
"Hello," she said. "Awful, isn't it? How on earth did they manage to do anything after dark in the old days?"
"Not such old days either," I told her. "This is the future as well as the past, provided there's somebody to show us how to make candles."
"I suppose so."
She raised her head and regarded me.
"You came from London today?"
"Yes," I admitted.
"It's bad there now?"
"It's finished," I said.
"You must have seen some horrible sights there," she suggested.
"I did," I said briefly. "How long have you been here?" She gave me the general picture of things without more encouragement. Coker's raid on the university building had netted all but half a dozen of the sighted. She and Miss Durrant had been two of those overlooked. During the following day, Miss Durrant had taken somewhat ineffective charge. There had been no question of their leaving right away, since only one among them had ever attempted to drive a lorry. During that day and most of the next, they had been in almost the same relationship to their party as I was to mine away in Hampstead. But during the later part of the second day, Michael Beadley and two others returned, and during the night, a few more had struggled back. By noon the day after that, they had drivers for a dozen vehicles. They had decided that it was more prudent to leave forthwith than to wait on the chance that others would come. Tynesham Manor had been chosen as a tentative destination for little better reason than that it was known to the Colonel as a place which could offer the compact seclusion which was one of the qualities they sought. It had been an ill-assorted party, with its leaders well aware of the fact. The day after their arrival there had been a meeting, smaller but otherwise not unsimilar to that held earlier in the university building. Michael and his section had announced that there was much to be done, and that it was not their intention to waste their energies in pacifying a group which was shot through with petty prejudices and squabbles. The whole business was too big for that, and time too pressing. Florence Durrant agreed. What had happened to the world was warning enough. How anyone could be so blindly ungrateful for the miracle that had preserved them as even to contemplate the perpetuation of the subversive theories which had been undermining the Christian faith for a century, she was unable to understand. For her part, she had no wish to live in a community where one section would be continually striving to pervert the simple faith of those who were not ashamed to show their gratitude to God by keeping his laws. She was no less able to see that the situation was serious. The proper course was to pay full heed to the warning God had given, and turn at once to his teaching. The division of parties, though clear, left them very uneven. Miss Durrant had found her supporters to consist of 5 sighted girls, 12 or so blind girls, 2 middle-aged men and women also blind, and 0 sighted males whatever. In the circumstances, there could be no doubt whatever that the section which would have to move must be Michael Beadley's. With the lorries still loaded, there was little to delay them, and in the early afternoon they had driven away, leaving Miss Durrant and her followers to sink or swim by their principles. Not until then had there been an opportunity to survey the potentialities of the manor and its neighbourhood. The main part of the house had been closed, but in the servants' quarters they found traces of recent occupation. Investigation of the kitchen garden, later, gave a pretty clear picture of what had happened to those who had been looking after the place. The bodies of a man, a woman, and a girl lay close together there in a scatter of spilled fruit. Nearby, a couple of triffids waited patiently with their roots dug in. Close to the model farm at the far end of the estate was a similar state of affairs. Whether the triffids had found their way into the park through some open gate, or some undocked specimens already there had broken free, was not clear. But they were a menace to be dealt with quickly before they could do more damage. Miss Durrant had sent off 1-sighted girl to make a circuit of the wall, closing every door or gate, and herself had broken into the gunroom. Despite inexperience, she and another young woman had succeeded in blowing the top off every triffid they could find, to the number of 26. No more had been seen within the enclosure, and it was hoped that no more existed there. The following day's investigation of the village had shown triffids about in considerable numbers. The surviving inhabitants were either those who had shut themselves into their houses to exist for as long as they could on what stores they had there, or those who had been lucky enough to encounter no triffids when they made brief foraging sorties. All who could be found had been collected and brought back to the manor. They were healthy, and most of them were strong. But for the present, at any rate, they were more of a burden than a help, for there was not one of them that could see. 4 more young women had arrived in the course of the day. 2 had come driving a loaded lorry by turns and bringing a blind girl with them. The other had been alone in a car. After a brief look round, she had announced that she found the set-up lacking in appeal, and driven on. Of the several who continued to arrive over the next few days, only 2 had stayed. All but 2 of the arrivals had been women. Most of the men, it seemed, had been more forthright and ruthless in extricating themselves from Coker's group formations, and most of them had returned in time to join the original party. Of Josella, the girl could tell me nothing. Clearly she had never heard the name before, and my attempts at description roused no recollections. While we were still talking, the electric lights in the room suddenly went on. The girl looked up at them with the awed expression of one receiving a revelation. She blew out the candles, and as she went on with her mending, she looked up at the bulbs occasionally as if to make certain they were still there. A few minutes later, Coker strolled in. "That was you, I suppose," I said, nodding at the lights. "Yes," he admitted. "They got their own plant here. We might as well use up the petrol as let it evaporate."
"Do you mean to say we could have had lights all the time we'd been here?" asked the girl.
"If you'd just taken the trouble to start the engine," Coker said, looking at her. "If you wanted light, why didn't you try to start it?"
"I didn't know it was there. Besides, I don't know anything about engines or electricity."
Coker went on looking at her thoughtfully. "So you just went on sitting in the dark," he remarked. "And how long do you think you're likely to survive if you just go on sitting in the dark when things need doing?" She was stung by his tone.
"It's not my fault if I'm not any good at things like that."
"I'll differ there," Coker told her. "It's not only your fault, it's a self-created fault. Moreover, it's an affectation to consider yourself too spiritual to understand anything mechanical. It's a petty and a very silly form of vanity. Everyone starts by knowing nothing about anything, but God gives him, and even her, brains to find out with. Failure to use them is not a virtue to be praised. Even in women it is a gap to be deplored." She looked understandably annoyed. Coker himself had been looking annoyed from the time he came in. She said,
"That's all very well, but different people's minds work on different lines. Men understand how machines and electricity work.
Women just aren't much interested in that kind of thing as a rule.
Don't hand me a mess of myth and affectation. I'm not taking it, said Coker. You know perfectly well that women can and do, or rather did, handle the most complicated and delicate machines when they took the trouble to understand them. What generally happens is that they're too lazy to take the trouble unless they have to. Why should they bother when the tradition of appealing helplessness can be rationalized as a womanly virtue and the job just shoved off onto somebody else? Ordinarily, it's a pose that it's not worth anyone's while to debunk. In fact, it's been fostered. Men have played up to it by stoutly repairing the poor darling's vacuum cleaner and capably replacing the blown fuse. The whole charade has been acceptable to both parties. Tough practicality complements spiritual delicacy and charming dependence, and he is the mug who gets his hands dirty.
He lunged on, well started now.
Hitherto, we have been able to afford to amuse ourselves with that kind of mental laziness and parasitism. In spite of generations of talk about the equality of the sexes, there has been much too great a vested interest in dependence for women to dream of dropping it. They have made a minimum of necessary modifications to changing conditions, but they have always been the minimum and grudged at that.
He paused.
You doubt that? Well, consider the fact that both the pert chit and the intellectual woman worked the higher sensibility gag in their different ways. But when a war came, and brought with it a social obligation and sanction, both could be trained into competent engineers.
They weren't good engineers, she remarked. Everybody says that.
Ah, the defensive mechanism in action. Let me point out that it was in nearly everybody's interest to say so.
All the same, he admitted. To some extent, that was true.
And why? Because nearly all of them not only had to learn hurriedly and without proper groundwork, but they also had to unlearn the habits carefully fostered for years of thinking such interests alien to them and too gross for their delicate natures.
I don't see why you have to come and pitch on me with all this, she said. I'm not the only one who didn't start the wretched engine. Coker grinned. You're quite right. It's unfair. It was simply finding the engine there ready to work and nobody doing a thing about it that started me off. Dumb futility gets me that way.
Then I think you might have said all that to Miss Durrant instead of me.
Don't worry, I shall.
But it isn't just her affair, it's yours and everyone else's. I mean that, you know.
Times have changed rather radically. You can't any longer say, oh dear, I don't understand this kind of thing and leave it to somebody else to do it for you. Nobody is going to be muddle-headed enough to confuse ignorance with innocence now. It's too important. Nor is ignorance going to be cute or funny anymore. It's going to be dangerous, very dangerous. Unless all of us get around as soon as we can to understanding a lot of things in which we had no previous interest, neither we nor those who depend on us are going to get through this lot.
I don't see why you need to pour all your contempt for women onto me, just because of one dirty old engine, she said peevishly.
Coker raised his eyes.
Great God! And here have I been explaining that women have all the capacities if they only take the trouble to use them.
You said we were parasites. That wasn't at all a nice thing to say.
I'm not trying to say nice things. And what I did say was that in the world that has vanished, women had a vested interest in acting the part of parasites.
And all that just because I don't happen to know anything about a smelly, noisy engine.
Hell, said Coker. Just drop that engine a minute, will you?
Well, then why?
The engine just happened to be a symbol. The point is, we'll all have to learn not simply what we like, but as much as we can about running a community and supporting it. The men can't just fill in a voting paper and hand the job to someone else, and it will no longer be considered that a woman has fulfilled all her social obligations when she has prevailed upon some man to support her and provide her with a niche where she can irresponsibly produce babies for somebody else to educate.
Well, I don't see what that has to do with engines.
Listen, said Coker patiently, if you have a baby, do you want him to grow up to be a savage or a civilized man?
A civilized man, of course.
Well, then, you have to see to it that he has civilized surroundings to do it in. The standards he'll learn from us. We've all got to understand as much as we can and live as intelligently as we can in order to give him the most we can. It's going to mean hard work and more thinking for all of us. Changed conditions must mean changed outlooks.
The girl gathered up her mending. She regarded Coker critically for a few moments.
With views like yours, I should think you'd find Mr. Beadley's party more congenial, she said. Here we have no intention of changing our outlook, or of giving up our principles. That's why we separated from the other party. So if the ways of decent, respectable people are not good enough for you, I should think you'd better go somewhere else.
And with a sound very like a sniff, she walked away. Coker watched her leave. When the door closed, he expressed his feelings with a fish porter's fluency. I laughed.
"What did you expect?" I said. "You prance in and address the girl as if she were a public meeting of delinquents, and responsible for the whole Western social system as well. And then you're surprised when she's huffed."
"You'd expect her to see reason," he muttered.
"I don't see why. Most of us don't. We see habit. She'll oppose any modification, reasonable or not, that conflicts with her previously trained feelings of what is right and polite, and be quite honestly convinced that she's showing steadfast strength of character. You're in too much of a hurry. Show a man the Elysian fields when he's just lost his home, and he'll think mighty little of them. Leave him there a bit, and he'll begin to think home was like them, only cosier. She'll adapt in time as she has to, and continue to deny with conviction that she's done so.
In other words, just improvise as necessary. Don't try to plan anything. That won't take us far.
That's where leadership comes in. The leader does the planning, but he's wise enough not to say so. As the changes become necessary, he slips them in as a concession. Temporarily, of course, to circumstances, but if he's good, he's slipping in the right bits for the ultimate shape. There are always overwhelming objections to any plan, but concessions have to be made to emergencies.
Sounds Machiavellian to me. I like to see what I'm aiming at and go straight for it.
Most people don't, even though they protest that they do. They prefer to be coaxed or wheedled or even driven. That way they never make a mistake. If there is one, it's always due to something or somebody else. This going headlong for things is a mechanistic view, and people in general aren't machines. They have minds of their own, mostly peasant minds at their easiest when they're in the familiar furrow.
Doesn't sound as if you bet much on Beadley's chance of making a go of it. He's all plan.
He'll have his troubles. But his party did choose.
This lot is negative, I pointed out.
It is simply here on account of its resistance to any kind of plan.
I paused. Then I added, that girl was right about one thing, you know. You would be better off with his lot. Her reaction is a sample of what you'd get all round if you were to try to handle this lot your way. You can't drive a flock of sheep to market in a dead straight line, but there are ways of getting them there.
You're being unusually cynical as well as metaphorical this evening, Coker observed.
I objected to that.
It isn't cynical to have noticed how a shepherd handles his sheep,
or to regard human beings as sheep might be thought so by some.
But less cynical and much more rewarding than regarding them as a lot of chassis fitted for remote thought control.
Hmm, said Coker. I'll have to consider the implications of that.
Chapter 11. And further on. My next morning was desultory. I looked around, I lent a hand here and there, and asked a lot of questions. It had been a wretched night. Until I lay down, I had not fully realized the extent to which I had counted on finding Josella at Tynesham. Weary though I was after the day's journey, I could not sleep. I lay awake in the darkness, feeling stranded and planless. So confidently had I assumed that she and the Beadley party would be there, that there had been no reason to consider any scheme beyond joining them. It now came home to me for the first time that even if I did succeed in catching up with them, I still might not find her. As she had only left Westminster District a short time before I arrived there in search of her, she must in any case have been well behind the main party. Obviously the thing to do was to make detailed inquiries regarding everyone who had arrived at Tynesham during the previous 2 days. For the present, I must assume that she had come this way. It was my only lead. And that meant assuming also that she had gone back to the university and had found the chalked address, whereas it was quite on the cards that she had not gone there at all, but sickened by the whole thing, had taken the quickest route out of the reeking place that London had become. The thing I had to fight hardest against admitting was that she might have caught the disease, whatever it was, that had dissolved both our groups. I would not consider the possibility of that until I had to. In the sleepless clarity of the small hours, I made one discovery. It was that my desire to join the Beadley party was very secondary indeed to my wish to find Josella. If, when I did find them, she was not with them. Well, the next move would have to wait upon the moment, but it would not be resignation.
Coker's bed was already empty when I awoke, and I decided to devote my morning chiefly to inquiries. One of the troubles was that it did not seem to have occurred to anyone to take note of the names of those who had found Tynesham uninviting and had passed on. Fiorella's name meant nothing to anyone save those few who recollected it with disapproval. My description of her raised no memories that would stand detailed examination. Certainly there had been no girl in a navy blue ski suit, that I established, but then I could by no means be certain that she would still be dressed in that way. My inquiries ended by making everyone very tired of me and increasing my frustration. There was a faint possibility that a girl who had come and gone a day before our arrival might have been she, but I could not feel it likely that Gisella could have left so slight an impression on anyone's mind, even allowing for prejudice. Coco reappeared again at the midday meal. He had been engaged on an extensive survey of the premises. He had taken a tally of the livestock and the number of blind among it, inspected the farm equipment and machinery, found out about the source of pure water supplies, looked into the stores of feed, both human and stock, discovered how many of the blind girls had been afflicted before the catastrophe, and arranged classes of the others for them to train as best they could. He had found most of the men plunged in gloom by a well-meant assurance for the vicar that there would be plenty of useful things for them to do, such as basket-making and weaving, and he had done his best to dispel it with more hopeful prospects. Encountering Miss Durrant, he had told her that unless it could somehow be contrived that the blind women should take part of the work off the shoulders of the sighted, the whole thing would break down within 10 days, and also that if the vicar's prayer for more blind people to join them should happen to be granted, the place would become entirely unworkable. He was embarking upon further observations, including the necessity for starting immediately to build up food reserves, and to begin the construction of devices which would enable blind men to do useful work, when she cut him short. He could see that she was a great deal more worried than she would admit, but the determination which had led her to sever relations with the other party caused her to blaze back at him unthankfully. She ended by letting him know that on her information neither he nor his views were likely to harmonize with the community. "The trouble about that woman is that she means to be boss," he said. "It's constitutional, quite apart from the lofty principles." "Slanderous," I said. "What you mean is that her principles are so impeccable that everything is her responsibility, and so it becomes her duty to guide others." "Much the same thing," he said. "But it sounds a lot better," I pointed out. He was thoughtful for a moment. "She's going to run this place into one hell of a mess unless she gets right down to the job of organizing it pretty quickly. Have you looked the outfit over?" I shook my head. I told him how my morning had been spent. "You don't seem to have got much change for it." "So, what?" he said. "I'm going on after the Michael Beadley crowd," I told him. "And if she's not with them?" "At present, I'm just hoping she is. She must be. Where else would she be?" He started to say something, then stopped. Then he went on. "I reckon I'll come along with you. It's likely that crowd won't be any more glad to see me than this one, considering everything, but I can live that down. I've watched one lot fall to bits, and I can see this one's going to do the same, more slowly and maybe more nastily. It's queer, isn't it? Decent intentions seem to be the most dangerous things around just now. A damn shame, because this place could be managed, in spite of the proportion of blind. Everything it needs is lying about for the taking, and will be for a while yet. It's only organizing that's wanted." "And willingness to be organized," I suggest. "That too," he agreed. "You know, the trouble is that in spite of all that's happened, this thing hasn't got home to these people yet. They don't want to turn too. That'd be making it too final. At the back of their minds, they're all camping out, hanging on, waiting for something or other." "True, but scarcely surprising," I admitted. "It took plenty to convince us, and they've not seen what we have. And somehow, it does seem less final and less immediate out here in the country." "Well, they've got to start realizing it soon if they're going to get through," Coker said, looking round the hall again. "There's no miracle coming to save them." "Give them time. They'll come to it, as we did. You're always in such a hurry. Time's no longer money, you know." "Money isn't important any longer, but time is.
They ought to be thinking about the harvest, rigging a mill to grind flour, seeing about winter feed for the stock.
I shook my head. Not as urgent as all that, Coker. There must be huge stocks of flour in the towns, and by the look of things, mighty few of us to use it. We can live on capital for a long while yet. Surely the immediate job is to teach the blind how to work before they really have to get down to it.
All the same, unless something is done, the sighted ones here are going to crack up. It only needs that to happen to one or two of them, and the place will be a proper mess.
I had to concede that. Later in the afternoon, I managed to find Miss Durrant. No one else seemed to know or care where Michael Beadley and his lot had gone, but I could not believe that they had not left behind some indications for those who might follow. Miss Durrant was not pleased. At first I thought she was going to refuse to tell me. It was not due solely to my implied preference for other company. The loss of even an uncongenial able-bodied man was serious in the circumstances. Nevertheless, she preferred not to show the weakness of asking me to stay. In the end, she said curtly, "They were intending to make for somewhere near Beaminster in Dorset. I can tell you no more than that." I went back and told Coker. He looked around him. Then he shook his head, though with a touch of regret. "Okay," he said. "We'll check out of this dump tomorrow." "Spoken like a pioneer," I told him. "At least, more like a pioneer than an Englishman." 9 o'clock the next morning saw us already 12 miles or so on our road, and travelling as before in our 2 lorries. There had been a question whether we should not take a handier vehicle and leave the trucks for the benefit of the Tynesham people, but I was reluctant to abandon mine. I had personally collected the contents and knew what was in it. Apart from the case of anti-Triffid gear, of which Michael Beadley had so disapproved, I had given myself slightly wider scope on the last load, and there was a selection of things made with consideration of what might be difficult to find outside a large town. Such things as a small lighting set, some pumps, cases of good tools. All these things would be available later for the taking, but there was going to be an interlude when it would be advisable to keep away from towns of any size. The Tynesham people had the means to fetch supplies from towns where there was no sign yet of the disease. A couple of loads would not make a great deal of difference to them either way, so, in the end, we went as we had come. The weather still held good. On the higher ground there was still little taint in the fresh air, though most villages had become unpleasant. Rarely we saw a still figure lying in a field or by the roadside, but just as in London, the main instinct seemed to have been to hide away in shelter of some kind. Most of the villages showed empty streets, and the countryside around them was as deserted as if the whole human race and most of its animals had been spirited away. Until we came to Steeple Honey. From our road, we had a view of the whole of Steeple Honey as we descended the hill. It clustered at the further end of a stone bridge which arched across a small sparkling river. It was a quiet little place, centred round a sleepy-looking church, and stippled off at its edges with whitewashed cottages. It did not look as if anything had occurred in a century or more to disturb the quiet life under its thatched roofs. But like other villages, it was now without stir or smoke. And then, when we were halfway down the hill, a movement caught my eye. On the left, at the far end of the bridge, one house stood slightly aslant from the road so that it faced obliquely towards us. An inn sign hung from a bracket on its wall, and from the window immediately above that something white was being waved. As we came closer, I could see the man who was leaning out and frantically flagging us with a towel. I judged that he must be blind, otherwise he would have come out into the road to intercept us. He was waving too vigorously for a sick man. I signalled back to Coker and pulled up as we cleared the bridge. The man at the window dropped his towel. He shouted something which I could not hear above the noise of the engines and disappeared. We both switched off. It was so quiet that we could hear the clumping of the man's feet on the wooden stairs inside the house. The door opened, and he stepped out, holding both hands before him. Like lightning, something whipped out of the hedge on his left and struck him. He gave a single high-pitched shout and dropped where he stood. I picked up my shotgun and climbed out of the cab. I circled a little until I could make out the Triffid skulking in the shadows of a bush. Then I blew the top off it. Coker was out of his truck too and standing close beside me. He looked at the man on the ground, and then at the shorn Triffid.
It was... No. Damn it, it can't have been waiting for him, he said. It must just have happened. It couldn't have known he'd come out of that door. I mean, it couldn't. Could it?
Or could it? It was a remarkably neat piece of work, I said. Coker turned uneasy eyes on me.
Too damn neat. You don't really believe.
There's a kind of conspiracy not to believe things about Triffids, I said, and added, there might be more around here. We looked the adjacent cover over carefully and drew blank. I could do with a drink, suggested Coker. But for the dust on the counter, the small bar of the inn looked normal. We poured a whiskey each. Coker downed his in one. He turned a worried look on me. I didn't like that. Not at all, I didn't. You ought to know a lot more about these bloody things than most people, Bill. I mean, it must just have happened to be there, mustn't it?
I think, I began. Then I stopped,
listening to the staccato drumming outside. I walked over and opened the window. I let the already trimmed Triffid have the other barrel too, this time just above the bowl. The drumming stopped. The trouble about Triffids, I said as we poured another drink, is chiefly the things we don't know about them. I told him one or two of Walter's theories. He started.
You don't seriously suggest that they're talking when they make that rattling noise.
I've never made up my mind, I admitted. I'll go so far as to say I'm sure it's a signal of some sort. But Walter considered it to be real talk, and he did know more about them than anyone else that I know. I ejected the two spent cartridge cases and reloaded. And he actually mentioned their advantage over a blind man. A number of years ago that was, I pointed out. Still, it's a funny coincidence.
Impulsive as ever, I said. Pretty nearly any stroke of fate can be made to look like a funny coincidence if you try hard enough and wait long enough.
We drank up and turned to go. Coker glanced out of the window. Then he caught my arm and pointed. Two Triffids had swayed round the corner and were making for the hedge which had been the hiding place of the first. I waited until they paused and then decapitated both of them. We left by the window, which was out of range of any Triffid cover, and looked about as carefully as we approached the lorries. Another coincidence? Or were they coming to see what had happened to their pal? Asked Coker. We cleared the village, running on along small cross-country roads. There seemed to me to be more Triffids about now than we had seen on our previous journey. Or was it that I had been made more conscious of them? It might have been that in travelling hitherto chiefly by main roads we had encountered fewer. I knew from experience that they tended to avoid a hard surface, and thought that it perhaps caused them some discomfort in their limb-like roots. Now I began to be convinced that we were seeing more of them, and I started to get an idea that they were not entirely indifferent to us, though it was not possible to be sure whether those that we saw approaching across fields from time to time just happened to be coming in our direction. A more decisive incident occurred when one slashed at me from the hedgerow as I passed. Luckily, it was inexpert in its aim at a moving vehicle. It let fly a moment too soon, and left its print in little dots of poison across the windscreen. I was past before it could strike again. But thenceforward, in spite of the warmth, I drove with the near side window closed. During the past week or more, I had given thought to the Triffids only when I encountered them. Those I had seen at Josella's home had worried me, as had the others that had attacked our group near Hampstead Heath. But most of the time there had been more immediate things to worry about. But looking back now over our trip, the state of things at Tynesham before Miss Durrant had taken steps to clear it up with shotguns, and the condition of the villages we had passed through, I began to wonder just how big a part the Triffids might have been playing in the disappearance of the inhabitants. In the next village, I drove slowly and looked carefully. In several of the front gardens I could see bodies lying as they had evidently lain for some days, and almost always there was a triffid discernible close by. It looked as if the triffids only ambushed in places where there was soft earth for them to dig their roots into while they waited. One seldom saw a body, and never a triffid, in those parts where the house doors open straight into the street. At a guess, I would say that what had happened in most of the villages was that the inhabitants emerging for food moved in comparative safety while they were in paved areas, but the moment they left them, or even passed close to a garden wall or fence, they stood in danger of the sting slashing out at them. Some would cry out as they were struck, and when they did not come back, those who remained would grow more afraid. Now and then another would be driven out by hunger. A few might be lucky enough to get back, but most would lose themselves and wander on until they dropped or came within range of a triffid. Those who were left might perhaps guess what was happening. Where there was a garden, they might have heard the swish of the sting, and known that they faced the alternatives of starvation in the house, or the same fate that had overtaken the others who had left it. Many would remain there, living on what food they had while they waited for help that was never going to come. Something like that must have been the predicament of the man in the inn at Steeple Honey. The likelihood that in the other villages we were passing through there might still be houses in which isolated groups had managed to keep going was not a pleasant thought. It raised again the same kind of question that we had faced in London, the feeling that one should, by all civilized standards, try to find them and do something for them, and the frustrating knowledge of the frittering decline which would overtake any such attempt as it had before. The same old question. What could one do with the best will in the world but prolong the anguish? Placate one's conscience for a while again, just to see the result of the effort wasted once more. It was not, I had to tell myself firmly, any good at all going into an earthquake area while the buildings were still falling. The rescue and the salvage had to be done when the tremors had stopped. But reason did not make it easy. The old doctor had been only too right when he stressed the difficulties of mental adaptation. The triffids were a complication on an unexpected scale. There were, of course, very many nurseries besides our own company's plantations. They raised them for us, for private buyers, or for sale to any number of lesser trades where their derivatives were used, and the majority of them were, for climactic reasons, situated in the south. Nevertheless, if what we had already seen was a fair sample of the way they had broken loose and distributed themselves, they must have been far more numerous than I had supposed. The prospect of more of them reaching maturity every day, and of the docked specimens steadily regrowing their stings, was far from reassuring. With only two more stops, one for food and the other for fuel, we made good time, and ran into Beaminster about 4:30 in the afternoon. We had come right into the centre of the town without having seen a sign to suggest the presence of the Beadley party. At first glimpse, the place was as void of life as any other we had seen that day. The main shopping street we entered was bare and empty, save for a couple of lorries drawn up on one side. I had led the way down it for perhaps 20 yards when a man stepped out from behind one of the lorries and levelled a rifle. He fired deliberately over my head, and then lowered his aim. Chapter 12. Dead End. That's the kind of warning I don't debate about. I pulled up. The man was large and fair-haired. He handled his rifle with familiarity. Without taking it out of the aim, he jerked his head twice sideways. I accepted that as a sign to climb down. When I had done so, I displayed my empty hands. Another man, accompanied by a girl, emerged from behind the stationary lorry as I approached it. Coker's voice called from behind me. "Better put out that rifle, chum, you're all in the open." The fair man's eyes left mine to search for Coker. I could have jumped him then if I'd wanted to, but I said, "He's right. Anyway, we're peaceful." The man lowered his rifle, not quite convinced. Coker emerged from the cover of my lorry, which had hidden his exit from his own. "What's the big idea, dog eat dog?" he inquired.
"Only two of you?"
the second man asked. Coker looked at him. What would you be expecting, a convention?
Yes, just two of us.
The trio visibly relaxed.
The fair man explained. We thought you might be a gang from a city. We've been expecting them here raiding for food.
Oh, said Coker. From which we assume that you've not taken a look at any city lately. If that's your only worry, you might as well forget it. What gangs there are more likely to be working the other way round, at present. In fact, doing, if I may say so, just what you are.
You don't think they'll come?
I'm darn sure they won't. He regarded the three.
Do you belong to Beadley's lot?
He asked. The response was convincingly blank.
Pity, said Coker. That'd have been our first real stroke of luck in quite a time.
What is or are Beadley's lot? Inquired the fair man.
I was feeling wilted and dry after some hours in the driving cab with the sun on it. I suggested that we might remove discussion from the middle of the street to some more congenial spot. We passed round their vans through a familiar litter of cases of biscuits, chests of tea, sides of bacon, sacks of sugar, blocks of salt and all the rest of it, to a small bar parlour next door. Over pint pots, Coker and I gave them a short resume of what we'd done and what we knew. Then it was their turn. They were, it seemed, the more active half of a party of six, the other two women and a man being stationed at the house they had taken over for a base. Around the noon of Tuesday the 7th of May, the fair-haired man and the girl with him had been travelling westwards in his car. They'd been on their way to spend a 2 weeks' holiday in Cornwall, and making pretty good time until a double-decker bus emerged from a turning somewhere near Crewe Cairn. The car had made contact with it in a decisive way, and the last thing the fair-haired young man remembered was a horrified glimpse of the bus looking as tall as a cliff and heeling over right above them. He had wakened up in bed to find, much as I had, a mysterious silence all about him. Apart from soreness, a few cuts and a thumping head, there didn't appear to be a lot wrong with him. When, as he said, nobody kept on coming, he had investigated the place and found it to be a small cottage hospital. In one ward he had found the girl and two other women, one of whom was conscious but incapacitated by a leg and an arm in plaster. In another were two men, one of them his present companion, the other suffering from a broken leg, also in plaster. Altogether there had been 11 people in the place, 8 of whom were sighted. Of the blind, 2 were bedridden and seriously ill. Of the staff, there was no sign at all. His experience had been, to begin with, more baffling than mine. They had stayed in the little hospital, doing what they could for the helpless, wondering what went on and hoping that someone would show up to help. They had no idea what was wrong with the 2 blind patients, nor how to treat them. They could do nothing but feed and try to ease them. Both had died the next day. One man disappeared, and no one had seen him go. Those who were there for injuries suffered when the bus had overturned were local people. Once they were sufficiently recovered, they set out to find relatives. The party had dwindled down to 6, 2 of whom had broken limbs. By now they had realized that the breakdown was big enough to mean that they must fend for themselves for a time at least. But they were still far from grasping its full extent. They decided to leave the hospital and find some more convenient place, for they imagined that many more sighted people would exist in the cities and that disorganization would have brought mob rule. Daily they were expecting the arrival of these mobs when the food stores in the towns should be finished, and had pictured them moving like a locust army across the countryside. Their chief concern, therefore, had been to gather supplies in preparation for a siege. With our assurances that that was the least likely thing to happen, they looked at one another a little bleakly. They were an oddly assorted trio. The fair-haired man turned out to be a member of the Stock Exchange by the name of Stephen Brennell. His companion was a good-looking, well-built girl with an occasional superficial petulance but no real surprise over whatever life might hand her next. She had led one of those fringe careers, modelling dresses, selling them, putting in movie extra work, missing opportunities of going to Hollywood, hostessing for obscure clubs, and helping out these activities by such other means as offered themselves, the intended holiday in Cornwall being apparently one such. She had an utterly unshakable conviction that nothing serious could have happened to America, and that it was only a matter of holding out for a while until the Americans arrived to put everything in order. She was quite the least troubled person I had encountered since the catastrophe took place, though just occasionally she pined a little for the bright lights which she hoped the Americans would hurry up and restore. The third member, the dark young man, nursed a grudge. He had worked hard and saved hard in order to start his small radio store, and he had ambitions. "Look at Ford," he told us, "and look at Lord Nuffield. He started with a bike shop no bigger than my radio store and see where he got to. That's the kind of thing I was going to do. And now look at the damn mess things are in. It ain't fair." Fate, as he saw it, didn't want any more Fords or Nuffields, but he didn't intend to take that lying down. This was only an interval sent to try him. One day would see him back in his radio store with his foot set firmly on the first rung to millionairedom. The most disappointing thing about them was to find that they knew nothing of the Michael Beadley party. Indeed, the only group they had encountered was in a village just over the Devon border, where a couple of men with shotguns had advised them not to come that way again. Those men, they said, were obviously local. Coker suggested that that meant a small group. "If they belonged to a large one, they'd have shown less nervousness and more curiosity," he maintained. "But if the Beadley lot are around here, we ought to be able to find them somehow." He put it to the fairman. "Look here, suppose we come along with you. We can do our whack, and when we do find them, it'll make things easier for all of us." The three of them looked questioningly at one another, and then nodded. "All right, give us a hand with the loading, and we'll be getting along," the man agreed. By the look of Charcot Old House, it had once been a fortified manor. Re-fortification was now underway. At some time in the past, the encircling moat had been drained. Stephen, however, was of the opinion that he had successfully ruined the drainage system so that it would fill up again by degrees. It was his plan to blow up such parts as had been filled in, and thus complete the re-encirclement. Our news, suggesting that this might not be necessary, induced a slight wistfulness in him, and a look of disappointment. The stone walls of the house were thick. At least three of the windows in the front displayed machine guns, and he pointed out two more mounted on the roof. Inside the main door was stacked a small arsenal of mortars and bombs, and as he proudly showed us, several flamethrowers. "We found an arms depot," he explained, "and spent a day getting this lot together." As I looked over the stuff, I realized for the first time that the catastrophe, by its very thoroughness, had been more merciful than the things that would have followed a slightly lesser disaster. Had 10 or 15% of the population remained unharmed, it was very likely that little communities like this would indeed have found themselves fighting off starving gangs in order to preserve their own lives. As things were, however, Stephen had probably made his warlike preparations in vain. But there was one appliance that could be put to good use. I pointed to the flamethrowers. "Those might be handy for Triffids," I said. He grinned. "You're right. Very effective. The one thing we've used them for. And incidentally, the one thing I know that really makes a Triffid beat it. You can go on firing at them until they're shot to bits and they don't budge. I suppose they don't know where the destruction's coming from. But one warm lick from this and they're plunging off fit to bust themselves." "Have you had a lot of trouble with them?" I asked. It seemed that they had not. From time to time, one, perhaps two or three, would approach and be scorched away. On their expeditions, they had had several lucky escapes, but usually they were out of their vehicles only in built-up areas where there was little likelihood of prowling Triffids. That night, after dark, we all went up to the roof. It was too early for the moon. We looked out upon an utterly black landscape. Search it as we would, not one of us was able to discover the least pinpoint of a telltale light, nor could any of the party recall ever having seen a trace of smoke by day. I was feeling depressed when we descended again to the lamp-lit living room. "There's only one thing for it, then," Coker said. "We'll have to divide the district up into areas and search them." But he did not say it with conviction. I suspected that he was thinking it likely, as I was, that the Beadley party would continue to show a deliberate light by night and some other sign, probably a smoke column, by day. However, no one had any better suggestion to make, so we got down to the business of dividing the map up into sections, doing our best to contrive that each should include some high ground to give an extensive view beyond it. The following day we went into the town in a lorry, and from there dispersed in smaller cars for the search. That was, without a doubt, the most melancholy day I had spent since I had wandered about Westminster searching for traces of Josella there. Just at first it wasn't too bad. There was the open road in the sunlight, the fresh green of early summer. There were signposts which pointed to Exeter and the West, and other places as if they still pursued their habitual lives. There were sometimes, though rarely, birds to be seen. And there were wild flowers beside the lanes, looking as they had always looked. But the other side of the picture was not so good. There were fields in which cattle lay dead, or wandered blindly, and untended cows lowed in pain. Where sheep in their easy discouragement had stood resignedly to die rather than pull themselves free from bramble or barbed wire, and other sheep grazed erratically or starved with looks of reproach in their blind eyes. Farms were becoming unpleasant places to pass closely. For safety's sake, I was giving myself only an inch of ventilation at the top of the window, but I closed even that whenever I saw a farm beside the road ahead. Triffids were at large. Sometimes I saw them crossing fields or noticed them inactive against hedges. In more than one farm they had found the middens to their liking, and enthroned themselves there while they waited for the dead stock to attain the right stage of putrescence. I saw them now with a disgust that they had never roused in me before. Horrible, alien things, which some of us had somehow created and which the rest of us in our careless greed had cultured all over the world. One could not even blame nature for them. Somehow they had been bred, just as we bred ourselves beautiful flowers or grotesque parodies of dogs. I began to loathe them now for more than their carrion-eating habits. They, more than anything else, seemed able to profit and flourish on our disaster. As the day went on, my sense of loneliness grew. On any hill or rise I stopped to examine the country as far as field glasses would show me. Once I saw smoke and went to the source to find a small railway train burnt out on the line. I still do not know how that could be, for there was no one near it. Another time a flag upon a staff sent me hurrying to a house to find it silent, though not empty. Yet another time a white flutter of movement on a distant hillside caught my eye. But when I turned the glasses on it, I found it to be half a dozen sheep milling in panic while a triffid struck continually and ineffectively across their woolly backs. Nowhere could I see a sign of living human beings. When I stopped for food, I did not linger longer than I needed. I ate it quickly, listening to a silence that was beginning to get on my nerves, and anxious to be on my way again with at least the sound of the car for company. One began to fancy things. Once I saw an arm waving from a window, but when I got there it was only a branch swaying in front of the window. I saw a man stop in the middle of a field and turn to watch me go by, but the glasses showed me that he couldn't have stopped or turned. He was a scarecrow. I heard voices calling to me, just discernible above the engine noise. I stopped and switched off. There were no voices, nothing, but far, far away, the plaint of an unmilked cow. It came to me that here and there, dotted about the country, there must be men and women who were believing themselves to be utterly alone, sole survivors. I felt as sorry for them as for anyone else in the disaster. During the afternoon, with lowered spirits and little hope, I kept doggedly on quartering my section of the map because I dared not risk failing to make my inner certainty sure. At last, however, I satisfied myself that if any sizable party did exist in the area I had been allotted, it was deliberately hiding. It had not been possible for me to cover every lane and byroad, but I was willing to swear that the sound of my by no means feeble horn had been heard in every acre of my sector. I finished up and drove back to the place where we had parked the lorry in the gloomiest mood I had yet known. I found that none of the others had shown up yet. So to pass the time, and because I needed it to keep out the spiritual cold, I turned into the nearby pub and poured myself a good brandy. Stephen was the next. The expedition seemed to have affected him as much as it had me, for he shook his head in answer to my questioning look and made straight for the bottle I had opened. 10 minutes later, the radio ambitionist joined us. He brought with him a disheveled, wild-eyed young man who appeared not to have washed or shaved for several weeks. This person had been on the road. It was, it seemed, his only profession. One evening, he could not say for certain of what day, he had found a fine, comfortable barn in which to spend the night. Having done somewhat more than his usual quota of miles that day, he had fallen asleep almost as soon as he lay down. The next morning he had awakened in a nightmare, and he still seemed a little uncertain whether it was the world or himself that was crazy. We reckoned he was, a little anyway, but he still retained a clear knowledge of the use of beer. Another half hour or so passed, and then Coker arrived. He was accompanied by an Alsatian puppy and an unbelievable old lady. She was dressed in what was obviously her best. Her cleanliness and precision were as notable as were the lack of them in our other recruit. She paused with a genteel hesitation on the threshold of the bar parlour. Coker performed the introduction. "This is Mrs. Fawcett, sole proprietor of Fawcett's Universal Stores in a collection of about 10 cottages, 2 pubs and a church known as Chippington Durney. And Mrs. Fawcett can cook. Boy, can she cook." Mrs. Fawcett acknowledged us with dignity, advanced with confidence, seated herself with circumspection, and consented to be pressed to a glass of port, followed by another glass of port. In answer to our questions, she confessed to sleeping with unusual soundness during the fatal evening and the night that followed. Into the precise cause of this she did not enter, and we did not inquire. She had continued to sleep, since nothing had occurred to awaken her, through half the following day. When she awoke, she was feeling unwell, and so did not attempt to get up until mid-afternoon. It had seemed to her curious but providential that no one had required her in the shop. When she did get up and go to the door, she had seen one of them horrid Triffid things standing in her garden, and a man lying on the path just outside her gate. At least she could see his legs. She had been about to go out to him when she had seen the Triffid stir, and she had slammed the door to just in time. It had clearly been a nasty moment for her, and the recollection of it agitated her into pouring herself the third glass of port. After that, she had settled down to wait until someone should come to remove both the Triffid and the man. They seemed a strangely long time in coming, but she had been able to live comfortably enough upon the contents of her shop. She had still been waiting, she explained as she poured herself a fourth glass of port with a nice absent-mindedness, when Coker, interested by the smoke from her fire, had shot the top off the Triffid and investigated. She had given Coker a meal, and he in return had given her advice. It had not been easy to make her understand the true state of things. In the end, he had suggested that she should take a look up the village, keeping a wary eye for Triffids, and that he would be back at 5 o'clock to see how she felt about it. He had returned to find her dressed up, her bag packed, and herself quite ready to leave. Back in Charcot Old House that evening, we gathered again around the map. Coker started to mark out new areas of search. We watched him without enthusiasm. It was Stephen who said what all of us, including, I think, Coker himself, were thinking. "Look here, we've been over all the ground for a circle of some 15 miles between us. It's clear they aren't in the immediate neighbourhood. Either your information is wrong, or they decided not to stop here and went on. In my view, it would be a waste of time to go on searching the way we did today." Coker laid down the compasses he was using. "Then what do you suggest?" "Well, it seems to me we could cover a lot of the district pretty quickly from the air, and well enough. You can bet your life that anyone who hears an aircraft engine is going to turn out and make a sign of some kind." Coker shook his head. "Now, why didn't we think of that before? It ought to be a helicopter, of course, but where do we get one? And who's going to fly it?" "Oh, I can make one of them things go all right," said the radio man confidently. There was something in his tone. "Have you ever flown one?" asked Coker. "No," admitted the radio man, "but I reckon there'd not be a lot to it once you got the knack." "Hmm," said Coker, looking at him with reserve. Stephen recalled the locations of two RAF stations not too far away, and that there had been an air taxi business operating from Yeovil.
End of Disc 6.